Hello and welcome to another episode of Challenger City TO with me, your host, Ian Montgomery. This conversation is excellent because it's all about transit. Now, we talk about transit and what works and what doesn't and things like congestion in Toronto all the time. It feels like it's a recurring conversation at the dinner table these days. Toronto is not without its mobility challenges. So I thought I would get someone who speaks really, really well on the subject of transit. It also helps that he's Swiss, and I think they're known for a thing or two about transit in that country. So this is a conversation with Antoine Belayas. He worked in Metrolinx for a long time, so he's kind of seen how the sausage is made. He's very knowledgeable about transit, not just in Toronto, but globally. Currently works for a fantastic ticketing company called Fairtic, traveling all over the world, seeing how transit is working differently in different places. I think he really grasps what it means to be a Challenger City. It's not just about going and copying what places are doing elsewhere and bringing them to Toronto, but I really wanted to have a specific conversation around transit and how we solve some of the mobility headaches that we're experiencing in this city right now. So without further ado, here is a conversation with Antoine Belayas. So Antoine, thank you so much for agreeing to be part of this podcast series, especially as you're probably one of the more opinionated and vocal people about the state of transit in Toronto. And I think you can do that because you're probably sufficiently removed from it, having worked in transit in the region and now doing it for a big global company out of Europe. But I want to get into like a bit about you. So let's have you introduce yourself to a bit of your backstory, what you do, what you're known for, and then we can go from there into Challenger City for Transit.
I was born in Geneva, Switzerland, where I spent my childhood and I lived until my high school certificate and mandatory army service. And then I moved to Montreal to study at McGill and was transferred to Calgary before coming to Toronto. And it's actually living in Calgary as a Swiss that alerted me to how we design our cities impacts how we experience them and how we live in our cities. And then after moving to Toronto, I did a master's degree in planning at the University of Toronto, and I worked a lot in campus planning. And repeatedly what happened in doing campus plans is that the question posed was, how do we grow? How do we build more buildings? And for me, the elephant was in the room, which was the number and size of parking lots surrounding these campuses. And I even heard once, well, the next building will be there. And they were pointing to a forest. And then I said, well, what about these parking lots? And they said, well, these are for cars. And it really alerted me to the relationship between planning and transportation. Then I did another master's in Sweden on sustainable development. And when I came back to Toronto, started to work for the Greater Toronto Transportation Authority, which then became Metrolinx, and the rest is history. I've been in the transportation bath ever since.
And then like now you're doing it with a ticketing business. Maybe let's give that a bit of a plug because I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I work for a company that does mobile ticketing for a number of transit agencies in Europe. It's a very unique system that's based on check-in, check-out. It's completely hardware-free and focused really on providing an excellent experience to the user. All you have to do is check in when you start your trip and then check out at the end. You don't have to do anything at transfer points and at the checkout. You don't even need to do it yourself. The system detects that you're no longer traveling by transit and checks you out. So we've taken all the complexity of determining what kind of ticket to buy or zones, distance, et cetera, or even which operator you need to buy the ticket from. There's just one button. And that's what I do now, following the work that I did at Metrolinx. And in the last 2 years I was there, I worked on fare and service integration.
So we can kind of see your lens for this is sort of, you live in Toronto, you've been in Toronto for a long time. You've seen how some of the sausage is made behind the scenes, because I want to talk a bit about what we see as passengers and what we don't see. But now you get to talk about it as someone who just lives here, travels a lot for work, spends a lot of time with other, dare I say, more progressive transport systems. Before we go into it a bit further, a few people have brought up the thing of Toronto is like New York run by the Swiss. And as a Swiss person, I feel like I have to ask you of what's your reaction to that analogy? Because I think it might be controversial.
Toronto eternally tries to compare itself to other cities and eternally tries to achieve the status of world-class city. And I think the best demonstration is the renaming, I think, of a street for Taylor Swift, which had a number of people roll their eyes. But it's very typical of Toronto wanting to be a world-class city. Toronto's just Toronto, and there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it in Europe. It's not Switzerland, and it's not New York. It's just Toronto. And I think that's why we need to love the city and learn to love the city, because it's unique. It has its faults, but it's also a great place to live and a place that is forming. It's a teenager city. And so there's so much that can be done, but it's also why it can be so infuriating, like teenagers are, when we see how quote unquote easy it would be to be better and we're not.
I love that, because to me, a Challenger City looks to other cities to be inspired, but doesn't necessarily try and be. We don't want to be Geneva. We don't want to be New York. We don't want to be London. But we can be inspired by those places, but we are our own thing. What does the Challenger City mean to you?
As you said, I travel a lot, and then I come back to Toronto, and like everyone, I have to get around. I'm quite lucky in that when I'm in Toronto, I work from home. But when I travel a lot. So I get to experience a lot of transportation systems throughout Europe. I try not to fly as little as possible when I'm in Europe. And I get to see everything from a local bus, a streetcar, or a national train. And then I come here. I can't remember, honestly, last time I drove. So I really use public transit and I bike. And I do notice a difference in how it works here. I mean, it's undeniable.
What do you notice?
Well, first, it's general dinner conversation, how horrible transportation is. And I don't need to explain to people how difficult it is. I have to say, my experience is focused on the downtown, but having worked at Metrolinx, I know that the situation is dire everywhere. But there's definitely some pinch points. What I see is the symptoms of congestion and the symptoms of unreliable transit, which in fact are correlated. But I see a lack of attention to the problem. We talk about the problem a lot, but we're not doing very much about it. And when we talk about doing something, we talk about very discrete actions as opposed to systemic change. And I think what we don't do is that we don't talk about the physical problem, which is the space that we have at disposal and what we're trying to do with it, and the competition between the modes of transportation that have to use the same space.
Why do you think we're so bad at this? Because we talk about, you're right, it's dinner conversation. There are far more interesting things to talk about over dinner than how bad the traffic or the transit is in Toronto. But why is Toronto struggling with this? Is it just the fact that it's a teenager city? Is there something underlying it that makes Toronto specifically bad at congestion and transit?
I think it's very, very difficult to understand exactly why this is. I can tell you some factors. I think that federalism is not helping. So we have different sources of money from the federal government, the provincial government, and the city. We have a structure of downtown and concession roads in the suburbs that is actually not very helpful to have a well-functioning transportation system. The situation in the suburbs is very different. But that grid downtown doesn't really make it easy, for example, to have fast-moving public transit. And I think we are a little bit inward-looking, and we're not willing and ready to look at what other cities are doing. And I actually think that we have a governance issue. I think we're not well-structured to actually understand the problems and tackle these problems.
Are there other cities that have been through this kind of thing that Toronto is going through? You say we're inward-looking. I don't necessarily know if Toronto's transit challenge is necessarily a unique to Toronto thing. Lots of other places have underinvested in transit and then done something to course correct it. I'm curious how you think about that.
I'm not sure that examples of other cities are necessarily useful, but in general, what you see is political leadership that decides to do something about it. I think what you see happen is the realization that all modes need to be viewed together. But I'll give you an example. And it's not necessarily an example that's directly relevant to Toronto, but I have a client, which is a region in the Czech Republic, and it's rural or semi-rural. There's small centers here and there, but mostly fairly low density. And this region had the heritage of communism with fairly high transit use. So they have this good foundation. But otherwise, the system was not functioning well. They had different operators that had their own ticketing systems. They had their different fare structures. And actually getting around the region by transit was difficult. It was really not for the faint of heart. And our client is actually the head of the transportation committee of the region. And he's really seized the problem and done something with it. So what he's done is that he's integrated all the modes of transit in the region with a unique single fare structure and working with us, providing the first channel that allows transit users to just check in one area of the region and check out in the other, not paying attention at all to the mode of transportation. So why is it relevant? Because you have this political leadership, but the framework was right for this one person to say, this is a problem I can tackle, because he had this leadership position in the regional government as head of the transportation committee. If you observe what we don't have in Toronto, we don't have anyone that's really responsible for transportation outcomes. We have the TTC that's responsible for transit, but the TTC does not have its own budget. It relies on the city for its budget. And yet at the city, we don't have anybody who has what the province would call agency oversight. So the TTC is very independent. And to be honest, I'm not sure exactly how it's managed from the mayor's office, from I don't know. We have transportation services that's mostly focused on roads. So do they work together? Absolutely. But then we have city planning that is responsible for the official plan. But if you look at all these documents, they all operate in silos. They're not structured or organized to deal with the challenge that I described, that we have airspace and a lot of demand for it. So going back to my client, I thought that was a recipe for success and a small example of what can be done. There's other examples like Madrid that has really reinvented its transportation system and built a lot of infrastructure over the last few years. But I find that the story is usually the same. When you go from a lack of success to a lot of success, it's usually because the governance is right. And it is because somebody has combined the responsibility for transportation outcomes, I would say all modes, but especially transit, and viewed scarce resources, so money, space, as something that needs to be allocated rationally to deliver outcomes. And money training is also important. So you have a plan, then you execute on the plan, and then you report on the plan. So that means that the reporting is transparent, and we understand what is being done, what is not being done, and then we can rectify it.
It feels like here you have this sort of, you have the TTC thing, which often doesn't feel very professionally transit driven. It feels more sort of the oversight is a bunch of amateurs who run for Cap City Council. And they might have the right intentions, but they don't actually understand how a transit system works. And then we have the Metrolinx thing, which has provincial aspirations, but you're sort of managing for a wider province. But actually, a lot of the heart of it is happening in the city. And then you have a Ministry of Transportation that often tends to be more biased towards roads and therefore driving and not necessarily. Public transit seems to take a bit of a backseat. Well, I think you said this a lot in some of these conversations, but I couldn't point to what the strategy is for mobility in the city. And we can't point to it for housing. We can't necessarily point to it or what does the city want to be. But without that structure, it feels like we're running from problem to problem without necessarily going, how do we make transit great?
First, I think we need to be fair. Other North American jurisdictions really envy the resources that we have. Actually, from the capital standpoint, I actually don't think that the issue is the lack of money, because Metrolinx is building a lot and there's a lot in the pipeline. I also think that the service that TTC puts out is great. I mean, the frequencies are great. The issue is that there's no real coordination. It's really difficult to understand who's in charge of what, or if we understand who's in charge of what, we don't know who is responsible for outcomes. So I'm a citizen and I want to get from A to B and I can't. So who do I blame? You'd say, well, it's transportation services because there's a dumpster in the bike lane. It's TTC because my vehicle is not arriving on time. It's Metrolinx because this project is late. So this fragmentation of responsibilities means that everybody's in charge of something, but nobody is in charge of the whole. And yes, we could boil the ocean and say we should do like New South Wales and have a single transportation agency that does everything. Does it solve all the problems? No. There's still rivalry between roads and transit in transport in New South Wales. But I think we need to look at outcomes that we want, and there are different dimensions. So you talked about Metrolinx and the TTCs. We need to think as the customer, not a Go customer or an Eglinton Line customer or a TTC customer, but a customer. And I think the initiative that we saw recently, One Fare, goes in the right direction, acknowledging that people use more than one system. But then all of a sudden, we had contract negotiations, and we somewhat froze the movement towards service integration between Toronto and other regions. But then at the scale of the city even, we don't have that coordination between the various modes and between the different departments that would really deliver better outcomes, but also allow us to understand, you know, where the problems are and who is not delivering them these outcomes.
In some ways, it seems that there's this lack of inventiveness of where transit can turn up and be useful. And I use the example of, you and I have commented on a lot of people shouting about the Gardener recently on places like LinkedIn. But a lot of people see like the journey that they need to take place is, well, I haven't got a train station near me in the suburbs, so therefore I'm going to drive all the way. Whereas actually in reality, I look at the people who are sat in that traffic, and it's sometimes the car isn't a bad thing. We don't need to demonize the car, but the car has its places. The car can take you from your detached home 2 or 3 kilometers to the station, where you can then change onto a train that hopefully is going to get more and more frequent as it gets improved, and then bring you downtown. And okay, maybe you need to get a streetcar or a subway just to finish off the journey or to go to other things that you're doing in the downtown area. But the role of transit is not necessarily to say you don't need a car, but it's you can use your car a lot less. And I don't know if transit does a good job of, it's one thing knowing like who's in charge and what are the outcomes, but the car can be part of that system too. And I feel like we miss that, and the passenger doesn't necessarily realize it either.
If car can be part of this, the car needs to be a part of this, because it will continue to exist. And this is where, when I hear transit, say, fans, you say, well, cars are inherently evil. They're not, because they're very useful. And people are rational beings, and they will continue to use cars if they make sense. But we do have to acknowledge that the use of the car is subsidized. We do have to acknowledge that cars take a lot of space, and we don't have space for everybody to go everywhere by car. And if we continue to bank on that, we will not get anywhere. But you know what's interesting? If you go around the city and you look at the city of Toronto planning signs, and you see 50, 60-story buildings with a number of parking spaces you can count on the fingers of one hand, then you know that the future of the city is not going to be centered on cars. And you also know, and that's why I'm also optimistic, that all the people who are going to move there, they will become transit and cycling advocates, because they don't have a choice. They won't be able to order a taxi or a rideshare to go everywhere. And I think we need to acknowledge, I was in the suburbs on the weekend, and every time I go to these places where I'm flying over the Northeast US, which is basically contiguous sprawl, that it's not fixable in a generation or even two. So we are stuck with cars. Can they be more efficient? Can they be autonomous? Can they transport more than one person? Absolutely. But we're not going to put everybody in subways. We also have to continue to educate people that they can't have a GO station or a subway station within walking distance. Although Metrolinx's plan will put a station within walking distance of a lot more people, but we will continue to have to use different modes of mobility. One thing that's really interesting is that in Europe, you actually see electric bikes used a lot more. And electric bikes are really interesting because traditionally, I mean, hardcore cyclists can go 6. I have a colleague who rides over 20 kilometers or 30 kilometers in any kind of weather. Most people don't want to do that. But if you look at cities like Copenhagen that don't have particularly good climate, and then you put a motor on these bicycles, then your tolerance for distance is much higher than 2-3 kilometers. But what do we need to do that? When we hear the story of a 24-year-old cyclist who has to ride around a dumpster that was illegally put in the bike lane and gets killed by a dump truck, first we feel an immense sadness for her friends and family. But we also get one more signal that cycling is undesirable, dangerous, etc. And that's what we also need to think about, not just the user experience of transit, but the user experience of cycling. And even though we've made a lot of progress, there's lots of destinations I can go to almost entirely on biking within the city. The user experience of cycling is still not a positive one.
I think that the bike lane thing is interesting because we talked about this before in episodes where we said there's building more housing, but then there's building the right housing. There's installing more bike lanes, but there's doing the right bike lanes. And you can say the same thing about transit of, are we designing the right transit, not just adding more transit? But I think bike lanes is really interesting because you look at a lot of them and they've got obstacles in the way. You have people parking their cars in them. They've just increased the fines for parking and cars in a bike lane. So hopefully that helps encourage a bit more enforcement of it. But it's that user experience of, like, I totally agree on the bike lane. I'd also say on buses, like, most TTC buses are kind of loud, ugly, noisy, uncomfortable, bone-shaking rides.
Let's talk about that. I just want to pick up on what you said. I think the quality of bike lanes is really important, but I think the city is learning and they're getting better and better. The bike lanes that are being installed on University Avenue promise to be, I think, quite spectacular. The issue is connectivity. And that's also a beef of drivers, is, well, there's no one in this bike lane. Well, maybe there's not as many people in this bike lane as there should be because it's not connected to anything and it just dumps me in a highway. There's a lot of bike lanes like that that take you to the downtown core and then you end up on Yonge or Bay at rush hour and it feels like a Super Mario. So there's definitely a qualitative aspect and we need to think of the cycling experience and the transit experience. Buses. I used to oversee the Metrolink's bus procurement on behalf of municipalities. And I remember arriving and saying, why do we have to buy these buses? Because I don't think they're horrible. They're just not great. And it's actually very complicated. We have non-tariff barriers. We have a Canadian content. But that's, again, not a customer-centric view. And I was flabbergasted to see in Prague that they buy four-door buses. And so, yes, it reduces the number of seats. But imagine how easy it is to get in and out of a bus with four doors. And so that's really thinking about the customer experience, making it efficient. Because what people don't like about buses is being stuck, right? It's like, oh, I have to fight past these people to get out. But if you know that you can go in and out like a streetcar or a subway car with very wide doors, and it's very easy to access. It's very easy if you have a stroller, if you have a walker, then it removes an obstacle to you taking the bus. And the bus is magical. We put a ton of bus lanes and bus facilities and bus priority in the last regional transportation plan because we won't be able to build subways and streetcars and LRTs everywhere. So the bus needs to play a very important role. It's not fancy. It's not desirable in North America, but I think the opportunity exists to make the bus attractive by making it clean, efficient, but most particularly frequent and reliable.
Mm-hmm. I think the TTC does quite well on frequencies. I think it does relatively well on reliability. It's just getting on a Nova bus. There are better, nicer manufacturers of buses out there that have smoother rides, quieter rides, more doors, whatever it might be, but they're just designed a bit more around passengers.
I'll give you a couple things about buses. There's a trend now towards plastic seats. And so at first I thought these are horrible and we should never have plastic seats. And that's because of the seats that I saw that really told you, you are a dirty person and I need to be able to spray wash the bus after you take it. And it's not comfortable, it's sweaty, etc. But I've seen plastic seats or I would say plastic-like materials being done well. It's all about sending the image or the signal to the customer that they're respected and that we want them there. Not, oh no, a dirty customer, you're going to dirty my bus, so we're just going to make it maintenance free. Another thing is customer information. It's taken a very long time, but the TTC is finally installing screens or updating the software to give you the next few stops. It took how long before we had the pixelated red signs? Then we had screens that didn't show anything. But let's vault past that. If you look at your average European city, and not even big, rich fancy Western European cities, but I was just in Bratislava, Slovakia, one of the poorest countries in Europe. And the cities were spectacular. They give you the next few stops, the connection points, what services you will connect to, what disruptions are on the system, what other operators you're connecting with, as well as maybe community information that or PSAs that help offset part of the cost of these trains.
Yeah, I think so. That is the bus is the classic example for me, because it's always been designed in North America as the mode of transport of the last resort. But if you make the seats plastic and make it look like you can spray them down with a pressure washer, people won't treat the bus with respect. And then you end up in this spiral of, how do we make them more and more utilitarian, less and less nice for people to actually be on? Whereas that, you would never sell a car with a plastic wiped down seat unless you were using it as a dune buggy. So like making the bus actually something that's like a nice place to sit or stand for a few minutes as you're going on your journey, having the right information. And I think the same things, well, like flipping and flopping between buses and bikes here, but like sometimes it's not necessarily about putting your bike on the bus. I know that's a big thing in North America. But having the parking in the transit stop to leave your bike and then transition onto the bus, and having a bus driver treat a cyclist with respect when they're pulling in and out of junctions, really thinking about that whole user and passenger experience, the bike lane, the buses, the transit station. So it feels nice. And then it's just like, it feels as nice as your car. And at that point, you can then justify getting out of the car and using the transit. I think that's the next big leap that Toronto is actually quite advanced for North America, but it's got a long way to go to catch up with what Asia and Europe does.
You know, I will disagree with you a little bit, because the research shows that what's really, really important is the quality of service in terms of frequency and reliability. And of course, that it takes you where you want to go. Annoying transfers, nobody likes that. They're frequent, reliable. And when it stops there, as long as it's safe and clean, I mean, the basics, all the other things are not really very high in passengers' priorities. However, I think that it's also the way that the questions are formulated. And so is for you a frequent, reliable bus more important than pretty uniforms on staff? Obviously. But this is when I think I will now agree with you that we need to look at the overall experience and the overall feelings that it elicits. We don't think enough about the emotional aspect of transportation. And that's something that I think obviously airlines do very well. Via Rail now with its new trains does very well. I think to an extent, Go has been focusing on the little aspects of the experience. It's something that was part of discussions to design the experience of Up Express. It was very, very important for Up Express because it was a premium product. Now we need to adopt this for transit. And that's something that Andy Byford really understood. Again, do we need pretty uniforms? No. Do we need a new logo? Probably not. A big pet peeve of a lot of people is the missing ceiling tiles in subway stations. Do we need these? No, we probably don't need these. But overall, it conveys a sense of neglect, and it conveys a sense that you're not wanted there. And so now we think we need to turn it around and say, cost effectively, how could we design a TTC that sends you the message that you're welcome, that we want you there, that you are a valued customer, without neglecting the most fundamental element, which is reliable and frequent service?
There's a bus route that I'll always point to, but it goes from Manchester to Burnley and a bit beyond in the UK. So it's not going to particularly wealthy areas. Burnley's, I think, one of the most deprived towns in Britain. But the buses that do that journey, they go every 15 minutes or so. It's about an hour's journey. They're double deckers. They have leather seats. They have Wi-Fi. They have big, comfy tables. The buses are all quite new, like 2-3 years old maximum. They're branded really beautifully, but it makes you look at that and go, you care. That's actually something I can go and sit on for a bit and be comfortable. And it doesn't become like unpleasant time. And I appreciate most TTC services are not quite the same. They tend to be shorter trips. But I think it's like turning that, the things that you see, like sweating the small stuff, that doesn't have to be super expensive. But if you have nicer seats, people will treat the bus a bit more respectably. If you have a nicer bus, less people will take an Uber. If you have less Ubers on the streets, you'll have faster buses. And I think all these things are kind of, there's a netting of like, how do you get all these little pieces right? And it ends up into turning into a better overall product. But I think that we miss that. You have to get the frequency and the reliability first, like correct first. I totally agree. But making transit feel cared for, I think, is so important.
Yes. And I want to give you an example. So that's probably because it's a competitive environment. I've taken trains throughout Central and Eastern Europe, and it's always a great experience. But all of a sudden, I took this Czech railway, Spandolino, and I was brought a glass of sparkling wine and snacks, etc. And I thought, what is going on? And there's a competitor, EU Express, on the same road. And so, yes, that will do that. Do we have the luxury to do that in an urban environment? We don't. But we can look at the attitude, the approaches. And that's what Budapest did. They had a really great system with a very high ridership inherited from the socialist era. But the system was frayed. It was not really well integrated. It had a poor image. It had reliability issues. It had very old vehicles. And my friend had this vision that it could be a lot better. It could be like Transport for London. And he attacked every aspect of operations and the experience. And you fast forward to today, and you go to Budapest, which is in Hungary, not a rich country. And you see a system that really seems cared for. All the vehicles are modern and the reliability is great. The information is available in Google Maps reliably. But it's the little things. They have a great logo. They have great wayfinding, very clear. They have English announcements on the metro. And then I'll make a little plug for integration, because you see the same logo on little zones that they've created on the street for scooters, bike share, because making this organization like Transport for London, they also made it multimodal. And so it has an overall view of the transportation system. And it's not just a transit operator. It has a municipal transit operator that they purchase services from, along with private companies that they purchase services from. But that entity, BKK, is not itself the operator. And that's something also that's very important. And that gets you probably better outcomes. And it doesn't need to be privatized, but it can all be in the public sector. But you have a distinction between the people who think about strategy and outcomes and the people who make sure that the service is delivered the way it should be. And you have one entity on the authority side that actually sets the targets, sets the objectives, sets the metrics, and another entity that delivers against these metrics. We don't have any of this in Toronto. I just don't know how the city makes sure that it gets its money's worth from the TTC, because it's the TTC that sets its own standards. I'll give you an example. The reliability of streetcar, the on-time performance of streetcars, is only measured at the endpoints, and 5 minutes late is considered on time. So every single streetcar can leave its endpoint 5 minutes late, and they will get 100% reliability score. Clearly, that is not something that was designed by the city and that somebody at the city monitors and can act against.
I think it's like the bus thing I originally was talking about is actually, there's no competitor on that route. Although I'd argue that bus is competing with, it's a private operator, but they are competing with the car. There's also a train route that goes a very different way around, but they're competing with the train. But I think sometimes we don't see that, okay, there might not be a competitor on this route for a bus or for a train or for transit, but the transit itself is competing with the car, the taxi, or just not traveling at all. And I think sometimes transit operators kind of miss that because they see themselves as the only thing in town. I think it's really interesting when you think about that thing for who's owning that, who's setting the standards, who's responsible for it, how are you measuring it? Especially when it comes to streetcars, because I see a lot of people saying, oh, we should rip these streetcars out. They're old and ancient things. They're no longer relevant. Toronto's in this really special position of it never got rid of its trams, but we don't necessarily appreciate them anymore. Like, we have new vehicles on old tracks, stuck behind traffic. The way we measure on time or not is questionable. It's totally this of like how we need to think of it all in one piece.
Streetcars or trams are my favorite topic because I love them. And I think they're absolutely amazing. They're a great mode of transportation. They will always be smoother than buses. And just having the tracks builds confidence that there's going to be a vehicle. The tracks are part of the brand of transit. It's like a promise that a vehicle will come and pick you up. We have put streetcars in a museum in Toronto. So yes, we were lucky to save them. But since then, we haven't modernized them. And now we basically call modern streetcars LRT. But in fact, we should LRTize our streetcar. And my European transit friends always say, I don't understand why you have LRTs and trams because they're the same thing. And it's true that if you go to a city like Prague, they're building new tram lines everywhere, but the way they're designed in the suburbs would be indistinguishable from the way we designed Finch or Eglinton. And then when they come in the city, you will notice several things. There is no intrusion of vehicles, very little intrusion of private vehicles on the tracks. The stations are much more distant, but each stop has a name and it's visible. It's like a subway station or a metro station has a name. It has amenities. It has a wide platform. There's very little walking across the street to access the track. Can we do this all of a sudden everywhere in Toronto? No. We also don't have the grand boulevards that often these trams run on. But if you go to a place like Prague, especially, they have streetcars that run in very tight spaces, but they still maintain the reliability because they've thought through how the tram would go without conflict with other modes. And in Zurich, they really looked at every inch of the streetcar route and thought about how to minimize intrusion by private vehicles in terms of traffic lights and turns. It is unconscionable that we allow a single left turning car to hold, I don't know, 100, 150 people hostage. And yet we do that. But that's symptomatic of not thinking about transportation outcomes, which is transporting as many people as possible from A to B. But we have one entity that does its best to run the streetcar on time and then gives itself some generous on-time performance statistics. And then another entity that has a goal of moving traffic smoothly and not getting yelled at by car users. We can't continue like this.
There's a consistent thing I see in Toronto is we don't like to make changes that can have exponential improvements for the majority if they come at a cost to a noisy minority. So I think I would use like the streetcar lines as an example of this. So it's really not like, okay, we maybe don't need College, Dundas, Queen, King. Maybe we need two or three of them. But if you made one of those streets priority movement for streetcar cyclists, pedestrians, they would become more like the boulevards that you see in Europe. More people would move east-west far more quickly, far more easily, far more comfortably, but it would come at a cost to some drivers. But we're not prepared to make that sacrifice. And I think like that's the thing of you need to have a leader that's able to go, yeah, some people are going to be really mad at me, but once I've made this decision and once we've played it through, the vast majority of people will be far happier and far better off.
I hate to break this to you, but I don't think we're that unique. And I think we should stop beating over ourselves that we're so unique, we're incapable of making decisions, etc. It's human nature. Nobody wants to anger an important voter base, but it is possible. And I think we have an example here. It's not perfect yet, far from it. But look at where we came from in terms of cycling infrastructure. There was nothing. It was really embarrassing how little there was. And now we have a network that is many, many, many times longer than what it was before. The key was to, and they figured it out. They figured out how to do it. It's a plan. It's funded. And it's rolled out. We need to be fast and decisive. And people need to see immediate benefits. I think it was a big mistake that the pandemic didn't help to launch the King right away and then basically let it die as a result of lack of enforcement, not making the infrastructure permanent, etc. Because what should have been done is, okay, this is very successful. We're going to keep building on it and then we're going to keep repeating it. So if you read various plans of the city, you see that the city is thinking about it and that there's a plan here and there. But nobody goes out and says, it's going to be amazing because you're going to be able to travel from A to B in half the time. And I promise that it will be done. It will be done in 2 years. Of course, it could be the mayor. But the mayor has so many other things that she needs to work on. She can't be the transportation czar. We also don't want to make the mistake of taking some bureaucrat and naming them transportation czar when they're not, they don't have the legitimacy of being elected. But I really do believe that we need to work within the Toronto system to identify a leader in council who is actually responsible for this. But if you look at the list of committees, you have an executive committee, okay. But again, where's my housing? You know, what about planning? What about this? What about that? And then there's no transportation committee. There's infrastructure and environment, and there's planning. If you look at the agenda of the planning committee, it's all about, you know, buildings. And then if you look at the infrastructure and environment, it's about very mundane, very practical, very minor things. I went poking around and I really can't find like a single place where somebody reports back and says, these are the metrics, these are the outcomes, this is how we're delivering. We do that a little bit with the TTC. So there's a CEO's report. We should have a CEO's report for transportation as a whole and standards and objectives that are set by somebody else than the person delivering that report.
It's that aspiration of what's the biggest possible thing that we can come to and we can imagine for, I call it mobility, but like moving around this city. And then what are the smallest possible things we can start doing? And then we build on those small things. And then that's where the momentum comes from. I've seen it too often that Toronto is like the city of, we do a pilot for something that was proven somewhere else 10 years ago. We just leave it as a pilot. And maybe it survives or maybe it dies, but we never build on the success of the pilot when the pilot has been successful. So King, when it's enforced, kind of works. The way it's enforced right now isn't sustainable. You can't just have people in high visibility jackets directing traffic and stopping drivers from doing the wrong thing. Like, we should then be building the infrastructure to make it a more permanent and more scalable thing. And I think that's the piece of it that's, I think your point around whether we call it mobility czar, or that the person that is effectively owning and responsible for moving people around this city, and that's not the CEO of the TTC.
No, but I'll say something that's not popular. So first, I agree with you that well-meaning people in high-vis jackets will not be enough to enforce, and it's very expensive. So yes, let's put cameras. Let's put cameras to enforce all kinds of intrusions on bike lanes, on streetcar lanes, etc. It's actually controlled by the province. So this is also the silent partner, because the province is not very evidently responsible for the city, even though cities in Ontario are creatures of the province. The province has demonstrated that it would not hesitate to make fundamental changes to council. But the province needs to really think about its responsibility. The city of Toronto, the Toronto region are essential to the economy of Ontario and of Canada. And so they need to take this role seriously. So it's unlocking these barriers that prevent the infrastructure from being used efficiently. And I would say, at the risk of not being popular, that the province spends a lot of money on transit capital, and since the pandemic, also operating. I think it might not be a bad idea, as is the case in European countries, both with the EU and national governments, to expect certain standards. And so we will give you this money, we'll unlock, we'll remove barriers to enforcement, etc. But then we'll work with you on metrics, but you will have to deliver on these metrics to continue receiving this money. And there's three ways you can measure transit success. One is objective metrics. So punctuality, frequency, the volume of service you put out, how much it costs per revenue passenger kilometer, etc. Then you have mystery shopping. The TTC is thinking about mystery shopping. Just do it. Mystery shopping is also a standardized way of measuring how the system functions from the point of view of the customer. And it's not just a snapshot. It's to see the evolution over time. And then, of course, customer satisfaction. And what the Swiss government, the Swiss federal government, does is that it does national mystery shopping using the same standards everywhere in the country. And then it publishes the results on its website. And there's always an article in the press, oh, we were again the worst in the country, or the German part is better, offers a better quality service than the French part, et cetera, et cetera. So that creates some accountability. And again, not that the city should not be consulted, but the province, and it does, the province has all kinds of performance metrics for everything, which are published on its website, but not for transit. And this is an area where I think that the province could help. Although, you know, what you say about the government and helping, it's not always well done, but it's worth exploring.
I think it's interesting that you're starting to touch on the things that there's what you can visibly see in transit, and there's those things that happening exist underneath, behind the scenes, that will ultimately translate into what you can see. I don't want to always be this critic, because I think there are things that are being done really rather well. We'll all complain about the Eglinton line not opening, But I think there are things that are happening to things like the GO train to go and make the GO train electrified, faster, more frequent, more reliable all day. The all day thing is wild that we still haven't got to that bit, but whatever, I'll park that. I think there's been things that have been done to make that are like slowly and incrementally improving those services. And I think there's a lot that we'll see in 5 years and be like, wow, we've missed this. I think it's the same thing that you see for the city. If you look at the skyline of the city of Toronto in the year 2000, there's not a lot there. You look at it now and it's completely transformed. Whether we like the architecture of some of those condos and whether those condos have been good or bad things is debatable, but like the skyline of Toronto is magical now compared to what it once was.
Okay, but let's talk about this. So the highways leading to downtown Toronto have been at capacity since the 60s. The 60s, right? So you can't put more cars there. So the only way that transportation capacity has been added is by walking. So a lot of people actually walk in the downtown. Cycling, same thing. And go, because we haven't added any lane of highway. But we haven't really planned for this. And it's been the planning, the development, the tremendous success. And I'm sure a lot of people have seen the statistics on the number of cranes that are magnitudes higher in Canada than in the US. So we have this explosive growth, which is fantastic. Great news. Lots of people are coming here, but a lot of stress on housing, for example, but also on transportation. And especially since we don't really plan the two together, we don't sufficiently plan the two together. And I think it's very intense downtown Toronto, where we've rather taken away streetcar capacity in the downtown and bus capacity. Everybody knows the number six bus on Bay Street. It used to be like a shuttle that came all the time, and now it doesn't. But why is that? It's not like there's fewer people downtown. And even if not everybody has come back to work, the city feels busy, and busy at all times of day now. And it deserves to have these frequencies, these excellent services, and especially reliable services. But we haven't planned, we haven't delivered on this.
And you have to put the infrastructure in, which is not necessarily the thing you see. You don't see signaling on the GO train. But once the signaling is done, you see more GO trains. Once you put another track in and you double it all day, you will see more GO trains and you will use more GO trains. And then all it becomes more visible.
And conversely, if you don't fix what is about to break, you will not get anything. It'll be very visible. Anyone can go and admire the state of tracks at King and Church. And the other day, I just disappeared into a hole. And it's welded, and it just seems to be really towards the end of its life. And it's not the only area where the TTC is really patching things with duct tape.
When there was a day when the street was closed for the Dundas West Festival, if you walk down that street and you look at the state of the tracks, and like it's partly because when you have cars driving on street car tracks, the street car track will degrade quicker. There's huge cracks, huge holes, the rails look in terrible condition. That translates into the ride, that translates into the reliability, and then you're back to digging up the street again. You have to fix those things. And then from there, you can then do reliability, frequency, and then transit nice on top.
Yeah. And you know, something fantastic happened. Now we have 5G in the tunnels of the subway, which is great news because there's all these slow orders, so we get to enjoy it more. So I'm being facetious. Why do we have all these slow orders? And that's something that I notice so vividly when I come back from Prague, Budapest, London, how slow the subway is. And it's supposed to be the spine of our transportation system. It transports so many people, and it's so slow. How did we get here? We should not get here. We should not have gotten here. And so we should be able to plan ahead. We're not a poor place. So there's too little money for the TTC, but we're not a poor place in aggregate. We should be able to afford this. And it's not a frill, because you cannot make do without the subway or transit in general.
I want to ask you one more question around infrastructure and then round us out around the magic wand question at the end. But when it comes to infrastructure, that we're not a poor city, we have money. I saw a thing the other day saying like the Ontario Line is possibly the most expensive subway being built in the world. When we've built transit extensions, the Eglinton LRT is super expensive. Why does building transit cost us so much here?
I wish I had the answer. I have read the same articles. I think we have to be careful to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. So first, it was because we had lost our hand So we stopped building for so long that we needed to rebuild that expertise. And so that meant training people and doing everything perhaps a little more slowly, getting consultants, etc. It's less and less going to be an excuse. We have good worker protection, salaries are like, do not compare our construction costs to Eastern Europe or even Spain, because our salaries are higher and it's a good thing. Now, I think there's a big component that is hard to explain. There's a researcher that's both at University of Montreal in Colombia, Marco Chidi, who specializes in this type of research. And I invite everyone to go and read his reports, because I prefer to focus on the customer experience and governance, et cetera. And I'm aware of the cost of construction issue. And it's huge, right? Because if it costs more money, then you can do less. Just like we overpay for buses because we have decided to only buy buses from two manufacturers. And if we could buy our buses from the international market, even from countries that have safer labor conditions, we would save a lot of money and we would be able to put out more service.
I think it's interesting. The thing to me is, yes, infrastructure is really expensive, but that should then force us to be, what can we do what can we do with a bus when we can't afford the train? What can we do with bike lanes that are comparatively less expensive? And how do we do the small things as well as the big things?
I had this not very original talk the other day that a streetcar is a subway that stops for cars. And so you can't just remove all the crossings. But if you compare the way a streetcar runs here to the way it runs in Germany, Switzerland, Hungary, or the Czech Republic, there's so much room for improvement. And it's so much cheaper than building in the subway. And it's, in many cases, our streetcar network is already there. So optimizing it is a lot cheaper than building new subways. Even in the suburbs, there's things we can do with elevated structures and with prioritized services. Everybody likes to talk about Eglinton, but Finch is like the wonder kind that nobody talks about. It's proceeding at a fast pace. The Hayes and McCallum line in Mississauga also proceeding at a fast pace. And I think we will see a lot of good surprises, and we need to continue doing that.
I think it's good to call out those ones because they do seem to be progressing well. And the other example I'd say is like Calgary's C train that got built downtown 40 years ago. That train, when it goes over a road, the traffic lights turn red and the train gets priority. If Calgary can figure that out, Toronto can do that with its streetcars. So I want to ask you the final, that's why I like to end these questions with, if I gave you a magic wand, what things would you do with that magic wand to go and make Toronto a challenger city when it comes to transportation and mobility?
Again, I need to break it to you, but there is no such a thing as a magic wand. And I'm not particularly romantic. I completely lack imagination. But I think if you wanted to think about long-term impact, I would really think about the structure of how transportation is planned, delivered, managed, monitored in the city to be much more multimodal and to have very clear responsibilities and accountability. That if something doesn't go well, the journalists always call the same person, and that this person stands uncomfortable in front of the cameras and explains why it's not delivered. And I think that with an outcome-based, multimodal approach of clear accountabilities and a plan, Toronto doesn't even have a transportation plan. So maybe we should start with a transportation plan. And I think that the rest will follow.
I like that. It doesn't have to be like the crazy outlandish thing. It sometimes is just, here's the keystone that effectively gets started. So I think having a plan definitely helps. We can worry about the magical stuff later. Antoine, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with me today.
Thanks for having me.
We might have to do this again, but it's good to do just a nerdy one specifically on transit. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Challenger City TO podcast. You can find written up versions of all these interviews, as well as a history of the other podcasts we've done to date, if you go to challengercityto.substack.com. We'll see you again for another episode very soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.